Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today we will continue the February-March 2025 issue of Guideposts with articles like Hawaii 5-0, Travels from the Heart. My son said I didn't understand him. He was right. Then came my birthday trip. Hawaii 5-0 by Lori Davies, Mesa, Arizona. We'd barely begun the hike to Maui's Waimakua Falls, and already Morgan, my 20-year-old son, seemed as if he might ruin it. He strode ahead on the trail, keeping 10 feet away from my husband Greg and me. "Come on, this is what you wanted to do," he said, widening the distance between us. So much for family togetherness. I had made no secret that for my 50th birthday trip to Maui, dubbed Hawaii 5-0 by Greg, the crown jewel of the itinerary, would be hiking the Pipawa Trail to the falls. We'd already driven the road to Hana, famous for its more than 600 hairpin turns, to get here, all part of the experience. For the past week, it had been the only thing I could talk about. We'd woken this morning to a forecast of heavy rains. "Let's hurry," I said. "I'm not missing this." Silently, I prayed, "Lord, let us get to the falls before the rain comes, and keep my right knee from acting up. Oh, and if it's not too much, help this be a way to connect with Morgan." At least I was still hopeful about my surgically repaired knee holding up and the rain holding off. We climbed until we reached a spot overlooking the seven sacred pools. A sign warned us to stay back from the edge of the cliff. I peered down, then looked to Morgan. Nothing, not a hint of emotion. When we moved out of our house a few months earlier, he told me I didn't understand him. He was right. The jungle was thick around us. It made me think of Morgan's childhood nickname. "Remember how we used to call you Mowgli?" I said. "I'm done living in the man village," he said dryly. "I'm off to find Bagheera and Baloo." What was that, God? Humor? It felt like a start. We hiked on, my knee catching and popping periodically just to let me know its displeasure at being pressed into duty. Mercifully, a massive banyan tree begged us to stop and gape. Aerial roots tumbled down like anchors, mooring their twisty thicket of branches to the jungle floor. My son flexed his muscles in the same configuration as the branches near him, and I maneuvered my smartphone's camera into just the right position to make it appear as if we were morphing into the tree. "I am Groot," he said, quoting a character in a Marvel superhero movie series. "Don't mix your metaphors, Mowgli," I said. "Good one, Mom," he said with a hint of disdain before taking a look at my photo. "Good one, Mom. Thanks. Will you send that to me later?" When was the last time Morgan had thanked me for anything? Then again, when was the last time I had thanked him? I typed a note into my phone about the idea that roots could start at the top and work their way down. We paused through a bamboo forest. The wind was howling, and so was my knee. The sky had filled with angry-looking clouds. If we were caught in the storm, there would be no Bagheera to rescue us. We hadn't seen a park ranger either. Greg offered me a hand up the final ascent. Where Morgan was, I wasn't sure. Lost in the tangle of exotic foliage and mounting worries, I heard the waterfall before I saw it. Seconds later, I gasped. A 400-foot torrent of water thundered down a sheer lava rock wall. I caught up to my son and aimed my phone at the white ribbon of free-falling tumble and force. My prayer for a special mother-son memory might not have been answered, but coming face-to-face with nature's majesty, wow. This was what I'd come all this way with my bulky knee to see. Before I could take a second photo, the skies opened up and unleashed a biblical torrent of rain. I looked incredulously at my family and then back at Waikimo Falls. "God, you held back the rain," I blurted through a gush of gratitude and tears. I'm not sure if it was the crack in my voice or the crack in my armor, but Morgan was moved too. Suddenly, he was at my side, helping me with my rain gear. But it was his expression that I noticed. There was such caring in his eyes, such love and concern. I couldn't remember the last time we'd really looked at each other. "We made it, Mom," he said. Did he mean the hike or us? I stole one last look at the falls before I turned to begin the 2-mile descent. Morgan startled me with a bear hug before he took my hand. "Thanks, son," I said. "Thanks, God," I added silently. I don't want you to slip, Morgan said, steadying me along the moss-covered rocks. An unexpected delight, like banyan tree roots that sprout from branches to reach the ground. As tangled as our relationship might be at times, we were going to be okay. Back at the car with the long drive to the Man Village before us, I settled into my seat. Happy birthday, Mom, I heard Morgan say softly. Today was a great day. Gratitude. It had come in a crash and a whisper. Yes, it was beautiful, I said. For more on this story, see Family Room. Grace and Inspiration, An Unusual Way to Heal a Broken Heart, Where the Light Enters, by Kimberly Elkins, Brooklyn, New York. On that August night 15 years ago, I raised my glass to Gino, the handsome lawyer I'd been dating since moving from New York to Boston to research my novel. Here's to our six-month anniversary, I said, with what I hoped was an alluring smile. He looked nervous, a little sweaty, unlike his usual composed self. Wait, was he going to propose? As a long divorced woman, this side of 40, I wasn't desperate to remarry. But if I were going to make that leap again, it would be with Gino. He was kind and smart and made me laugh. But instead of lifting his glass, Gino set it down. I'm sorry, but I don't think this is going to work. What isn't going to work? This, he said, gesturing. You and me. I looked around the crowded restaurant, the cozy Italian trattoria, where we'd had our first date, and wondered what would happen if I completely lost it. I tried to keep the wobble out of my voice. But you said you loved me. Gino took a big gulp of champagne. I do love you, he said, but I'm not in love with you. That's when the waterworks came. Loud, wrenching, strangers turning to look, tears dripping from my linguine sobs. Of all the nights to be wearing three coats of mascara, how would a wailing, raccoon-eyed mess ever convince the man of my dreams that I was the one? Gino reached for my hand just as the waiter appeared, probably worried that I would start throwing dishes. For a moment, I thought my beloved was going to take it all back and tell me he'd never leave me. But what he said was, "Check, please." A month later, I was still devastated, and Gino was still firm in his decision. I'd never had a heart this broken or felt so utterly rejected. What was so wrong with me that he didn't want me, not only in his future, but even in his present? When I wasn't teaching one of my college writing classes, my days alternated between weeping and sleeping. In the evenings, I vented to friends who were doubtless bored silly by all my doom and gloom. Desperate to distract myself, I headed to the closest bookstore to load up on novels. First up was Villette, the 19th century tragic romance by Charlotte Bronte. I figured my misery needed company. When I got home, I settled into my favorite comfy chair. I opened the book and noticed a small slip of paper secreted between its middle pages. Must be the receipt. I pulled it out to find written in neat block letters, "There's nothing more powerful than a broken heart, as long as you have a strong spiritual container to hold it." Anon. The message slammed into my soul. Could it be that those words were meant especially for me? As the days passed, I couldn't stop thinking about the quote. How strong was my spiritual container? Did I have a deep enough foundation to allow me to heal? I'd been so stuck on my feelings of sorrow and rejection that I'd forgotten to see where God was in the big picture. I thought hard about the concrete steps it might take to build up my relationship to God and to myself. First, I set about refocusing my prayer time, switching from my recent plaints of "Why me, Lord?" to opening myself again to praying more for others. Then I restarted my long-defunct project of writing out daily all the things, big and small, that I felt grateful for and meditating on them. Even though there was no current romantic relationship on that list, I was amazed at the bounty of things that still brought me great joy and sustenance. My writing, my teaching, my family, my friends, my faith. Last, from one of the dusty self-help books I pulled from my shelf, I took the advice of writing and saying aloud positive affirmations every day. I am enough. I am worthy of love. Things will happen in my life when they're supposed to happen. Over the next couple months, these changes I'd implemented made me feel better by leaps and bounds, but something still felt missing. I remembered the message from the Bronte novel that had jump-started my spiritual renewal. I always loved collecting inspiring and thought-provoking quotes myself and kept a journal in which I jotted them down on a variety of sources. Maybe, just maybe, I could help someone the way the mysterious message writer had helped me. The next day, armed with several of my favorite quotes penned on individual note cards, I headed to the bookstore. I skimmed the rows of jam-packed shelves. The most daunting task was finding which book would pair best with which quote. I finally settled on Zora Neale Hurston's novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, into which I slipped the message, "The wound is the place where the light enters you," from the 13th century Persian poet Rumi. A week later, at a different bookstore, I slid a note inscribed with Emily Dickinson's words, "I wish for you a kinder sea," between the pages of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. I prayed over each quote that the message might reach a person who needed that particular inspiration at that particular moment, just as I had. Over the next few years, even after moving back to New York, I continued my stealthy mission. Only once was I caught in the act in a West Village bookshop. A young female employee rounded the corner just as I was sticking my note into Flannery O'Connor's Complete Stories. "What are you doing?" she asked sharply. Before I could respond, she took the book out of my hands and pulled the note from its pages. She read aloud, "Deep water is not the same thing as drowning," a paraphrase of a quote from James Baldwin. The young woman looked at me for a moment, and I saw that she was starting to tear up. She told me she'd been up all night trying to write a paper for a grad school class and that she didn't know how she'd be able to finish it and pass the course. "This is just what I needed to hear," she said. "I'm in deep water, but the truth is I won't drown. Thank you." My own truth was that while I'd been rejected by a man, I would never be rejected by God. He'd reached out to me via a note left in a book, encouraging me to deepen my relationship with him and inspiring me to remind others that they too would make it through whatever life had thrown at them. My spiritual container isn't perfectly strong or foolproof and never will be. But I thank God I got the message I needed when I needed it most. As for Gino, it was his loss. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Making marriage work. Harping on my husband's health habits was hurting our marriage. There had to be a better way. Nag Not by Rebecca Chama, San Diego, California. My husband Jean-Claude and I sat down to dinner. Our nightly conversation started up. "What did you have for lunch today?" I asked. "Pasta," Jean-Claude mumbled. He looked glum. I said, "you need more fiber than that. Maybe you should supplement with a bean burrito tonight." Jean-Claude shrugged. "Did you exercise this morning?" Another shrug. "I walked to the office," he said. Jean-Claude is an architect. His office is a half-hour walk from our apartment. "You need to ride the stationary bike each morning," I said. "Remember what the doctor said." A few months earlier, a routine colonoscopy had revealed that Jean-Claude is at high risk for colon cancer. His doctor recommended a health makeover: high-fiber diet, more exercise, cut out the sweets and processed foods. I was already on the alert about Jean-Claude's health after a major scare several years earlier. He had symptoms that initially looked like lymphoma. It turned out to be sarcoidosis, an autoimmune disease. I became convinced my husband's health was extremely fragile. I feared every doctor's appointment. Every cough heralded doom. Never mind that Jean-Claude was able to work full-time and that we lived a full active life together. My fears became disconnected from reality. I saw my wonderful, vital, loving husband as a ticking health time bomb. It got worse after the colonoscopy. I nagged him mercilessly about his diet and exercise. We hardly talked about anything else. I monitored his every move and meal. I could tell he was wilting under my constant scrutiny, yet I couldn't stop. I struggled with anxiety most of my life. Midway through our 25-year marriage, I was diagnosed with a mental illness, schizophrenia. For me, the most disruptive symptoms are anxiety and paranoia. Medication has helped. I also rely on prayer, setting aside regular time to talk with God, combining it with meditation and breathing exercises. All along, Jean-Claude was my rock. He could always find a way to bring out the best in me. We could laugh and be silly together, until now. Nothing I tried helped. I started off each day with good intentions. Then I noticed Jean-Claude wasn't eating a high-fiber breakfast. The words were out of my mouth before I could stop them. Wouldn't high-fiber cereal be better? Then it was off to the races. What are you planning for lunch today? There's still time to hop on the bike before you go to work. Jean-Claude is patience personified. He never snapped at me. He just retreated into himself. It used to feel as if we never had enough time for everything we wanted to say to each other. Now every conversation sounded the same. Ash Wednesday was approaching. We attend a Lutheran church, so I'm attuned to the liturgical calendar. For Lent, I like to do more than give up a luxury. I try to find a spiritual discipline that will draw me closer to God. I was hunting online for a book of Lenten devotionals when a title caught my eye. Give Up Worry for Lent, 40 Days to Finding Peace in Christ by a Catholic writer named Gary Zimark. I ordered a copy and the first day of Lent opened it to the introduction. It is no secret that I have struggled with anxiety for most of my life, I read. Immediately, the author had my attention. He quoted Paul's words from 1 Corinthians. I want you to be free from anxieties. From that single phrase, Zimark concluded, if God wants us to be free from anxieties, it must be possible to stop worrying. For the first time since Jean-Claude's alarming colonoscopy, I felt a small ray of hope. Zimark promised his readers two things. The first was a one-day-at-a-time method of banishing worry from your life. The second sounded even better. More importantly, the exercises in this book will also help you draw closer to the Lord, entering into a deeper relationship with Him. Zimark made it clear that he is not a psychologist and that his devotions were not meant as a substitute for professional help. His book, he wrote, was meant to be more like supplements to mental health care. That was exactly what I needed. Each day began with a verse from Scripture, followed by short meditation on letting the verse settle into your heart. The first day's verse was Matthew 11:28. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Zimark urged his readers to close their eyes and imagine themselves actually going to Jesus and letting him comfort them. I tried it. I pictured walking to Jesus and letting him wrap his arms around me in a loving, protective embrace. Peace filled my body. The following day was similar, starting with verse 3:2 from Paul's letter to the Colossians, set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. Zimark's take on these words was you need to think about God more than you think about your own problems. If you constantly dwell on your earthly challenges and difficulties, you will never experience peace in your life. If, on the other hand, you keep your focus on the Lord and turn to Him each day, you will be at peace. I let that insight sink in. Getting my anxieties under control would require more than pestering God to do it for me. Instead of asking God, I needed to focus on God, just keep my mind on Him without an agenda. But how could I do that? Then one word sprang to my mind, gratitude. I happen to love pears. The next time I ate a pear, I focused on thanking God for the amazing miracle of the taste of a pear. Is there anything quite so delicious? I closed my eyes and focused on the sweet sensation. Thank you, God, for that simple gift. Anytime I felt myself succumbing to worry, I forced myself to say, I'd rather talk to you, God, than I looked around for something to be grateful for. A pretty view, a tree, something positive I'd seen in the news. Anything to provide a conversational opening with God. It was just as Gary Zimark had promised. The more I focused on God, the less I thought about my fears. As my fears receded, I truly began to experience the peace that God longs to give His children. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you, Jesus says in the Gospel of John. I was starting to believe it. Easter approached and I noticed something. Jean-Claude looked happier when we sat down to dinner. I asked why. You didn't ask me what I had for lunch today, he said. I didn't. You were telling me about the new devotional. Sounds like a great book. It is, I said. I think it's working. John Caud looked even happier. I began making a conscious effort to refrain from too many comments about my husband's diet and exercise. I pictured myself not only going to Jesus for comfort, but also bringing John Caud with me. I can't keep my husband healthy, I said to God, but you can. With God in charge, I didn't have to control everything. I didn't have to be hypervigilant. Instead, I could set my mind on things that are above, and I could feel it working. It's been about 2 years since John Caud got that worrisome colonoscopy. I'd be dishonest if I said I never worry or nag him about his health anymore. What is true is that my worries no longer control me. Thanking God for his constant loving presence has become a habit, one I reinforce by reading a devotion from Zimek's book every day, not just during Lent. I'm grateful for how I found it in the moment I needed it most. I slip up sometimes and catch myself interrogating John Caud. I stop, apologize, and then we talk about something far more interesting. The best part is that he and I are back to enjoying each other, and I'm able to enjoy simple pleasures to the full. You could say my life is full of delicious pears. Spiritual notebook. Church was the last place I wanted to be the offering. By Michelle Juarez, Schwartz, Texas. Sundays used to be my favorite day of the week. I would pop out of bed and get ready for church. I loved worshiping alongside my husband, Robert. It was a chance to grow closer to each other and to God. I used to leave church feeling renewed, excited for the week ahead. Used to, as in, no longer. For the past 2 months, ever since I'd been laid off from my job as a preschool teacher's aide, church was the last place I wanted to be. The idea that God was looking out for me personally, well, I wasn't buying it anymore. I dreaded talking to people after Mass with their questions about how my job search was going and their assurances that it will all work out. I would much rather be spending Sunday mornings hiding under the covers, the way I'd been spending every morning lately. This Sunday, Robert's family was holding a special Mass to honor his late father and brother. I had to go to church, but I didn't have to like it. I dawdled getting dressed, dissatisfied with everything in my closet. Are you ready? Robert said, poking his head in. Do I look ready? Instantly, I felt bad for snapping at him, but not bad enough to complain for one thing after the other during the entire drive to church. Could you park any farther away? I asked Robert as he pulled into a space. I walked slowly behind my husband as if putting off the inevitable as long as possible. Near the church entrance, a woman said to Robert, "Good morning. Would you and your wife like to carry the offertory gifts to the altar?" I held my breath. Presenting the bread and wine to the priest was an honor, symbolizing offering ourselves and all that we are to God. I was unworthy of that honor. I had let my family down. "We'd be happy to," Robert said, without even asking if I wanted to. The two of us took a seat in the last pew. In a whisper that sounded more like a hiss, I asked Robert, "Did you ever stop to think I don't want to be in front and center today?" It was as if my feelings didn't matter, as if I didn't matter. That was what hurt most about losing my job. A lot of my self-worth was tied up in it. After years of being a stay-at-home mom to our only child, our son Mikey, earning a paycheck and helping cover our household expenses were important to me. Robert's pay had recently been cut. We counted on what I brought in, especially with Mikey starting college soon. I felt like such a failure. The congregation rose for a hymn. The priest washed his hands while the deacon and altar servers prepared the altar. It was time. I exited the pew behind Robert. The gifts were placed in our hands. Slowly, we walked them down the aisle. I felt every eye on me. It seemed like forever before we reached the priest. I handed him the chalice of wine. Robert offered the bread. We bowed, then turned to go back to our seats. "Wait," the priest called to us. I stopped. Had I done something wrong? Robert and I stepped before him once more. I couldn't imagine what people must be thinking. The priest rested one hand on my head and the other on Robert's, then looked up and closed his eyes. I had never seen a priest do anything like this during the offertory. The priest prayed silently over us. A feeling of absolute peace washed over me, as if God had carried away my burdens on the tide of his love. the worry, anger, and shame I'd been feeling since losing my job. Instead of taking everything out on my husband, I needed to give all of it and all of myself to God, just as the presentation of gifts symbolized. I didn't know what the future held. I had to put my trust in the one who knew my worth beyond any job I might hold. Robert and I returned to our pew. I sat beside him and squeezed his hand. I left church feeling energized. The next morning, I woke early and practically leaped out of bed. If Robert and Mikey were surprised to see me, they didn't show it. After breakfast, I opened my laptop and scrolled through job listings. Nothing. Instead of being discouraged, I pulled out my grocery list. Tomatoes, cucumbers, lettuce, broccoli. Those fresh vegetables were expensive. Why not grow them myself? A gardener friend had recently given me some raised beds and pots. Robert went to work and Mikey to school, but I had no thought of going back to bed. I drove to the nursery and bought 2 bags of soil, some vegetable seeds and seedlings, even a philodendron. Back home, I went out to our yard. I filled a container with soil and added a tomato seedling, sinking my hands deep into the dirt. Before long, I had a whole row planted. I stepped back to survey my work, and I knew vegetables wouldn't be the only thing that grew this season. My self-worth would grow, too, in the rich soil of faith. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.